Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Matt Bennett. He's the co-founder and senior vice president for public affairs at a Washington think tank and advocacy organization called Third Way. It's dedicated to developing and advocating new policy ideas. Matt has appeared on the program before. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Now, as I just mentioned, we talked on this program earlier. I think it was 2 years ago, actually, almost to the week. And it was as the 2016 presidential campaign was beginning to take shape. It was a couple of months before the first primaries. And you were arguing then on the program that the Democratic Party was in a very difficult spot as a party. It was facing big challenges. And this was all despite having both demographic changes in the population appearing to be on its side and favoring it, and also, at least as of then, what appeared to be pretty good footing for retaining the White House. So here we are 2 years later. The Democrats have now lost the White House. So where does this put the party now?
Yeah, it's a lot worse than it was 2 years ago and worse than even I could have imagined when we spoke last time. Nobody saw Donald Trump coming, of course. Nobody saw Donald Trump winning. And so the party is now in its worst electoral shape, notwithstanding what happened last week in Virginia, that it's been in since Reconstruction. It's a catastrophe. The Democrats have lost 1,000 state legislative seats. They're down to just a handful of governors, something like 17. They've obviously don't have either House of Congress, and Trump is in the White House. So this is a really, really deep hole that Democrats are in. And the question is, how do they climb out of it? Mm. You noted that we talked a little bit about demography last time, and it's true that the country is getting younger and less white, but it's moving pretty slowly in that direction. We're going to be a majority white country until at least 2050. And those folks, for the most part, Latinos and Hispanics, are clustered in small geographic areas, which means it's very hard for Democrats to count on them to pull them out of this electoral hole.
Now, there's something that strikes me about the current climate. It does seem right now like both the major parties at the same time are going through their own versions of a pretty fractious self-examination period. And, you know, the Democratic Party is united against Trump, but it's not as clear what it's for. And so I was just curious, in your research and thinking and understanding about this, has there been another time in our history when both parties were going through this kind of self-examination at the very same time? And does that fact say something about the country in important ways?
I don't think it's happened in the modern era at the exact same time. Virtually all reconsiderations for parties happen in the immediate aftermath of losing the White House. That's when you have a civil war. That's when you sort out who you are. That certainly happened with Democrats in 2000 when kind of the Daily Kos wing of the party became a Senate for a while. Howard Dean looked like he might win the 2004 nomination. So there was a real struggle going on then for Democrats. Certainly Republicans went through this after 2008 with the Tea Party. But having the White House is supposed to keep a lid on intra-party fighting. Hmm. The president is the leader of the party, and you're not supposed to have these spats out in public when you've got the White House, particularly when you're in the very first year of a new presidency. So it isn't surprising that Democrats, in the wake of this catastrophic loss last year, are having this debate. It is incredibly surprising that Republicans are.
Well, and isn't that just basically due to the man who's in the White House? Or, I mean, tell me what's going on there in your view.
Right. No doubt. I mean, we've never had a president like Donald Trump in every way. In particular, we've never had a guy who surrounded himself with people that were openly at war with the establishment of their own party. Now, Steve Bannon no longer works in the White House, but he has declared war, using that word, on Mitch McConnell, the leader of the party in Congress, or at least in the Senate, and to a lesser extent on Paul Ryan. So this is completely new in politics, at least in modern politics. Never seen it before. By contrast, Democrats, to your point, are united around one thing, which is we got to get rid of Trump. We've got to recover some power. And that has drawn together the wings of the party in ways that are unusual for this point in a cycle.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Matt Bennett, Senior Vice President for Public Affairs for the think tank Third Way. Now, your organization is more associated with the Democratic Party. I want to look at them a little more deeply. Tell me more exactly, what are the big things that the Democratic Party is sorting out right now?
Well, historically, at least since the 80s and 90s, the fracture in the party was over social issues. When Bill Clinton was first running for president in 1992, they were struggling with questions around race, having to do with crime back then, around abortion and guns. Those fractures have, for the most part, disappeared. Democrats across the spectrum, from the most liberal to the most centrist, all for the most part agree on things like LGBT equality and abortion and guns. The new fault lines in Democratic politics are around new kinds of litmus test politics, but they're mostly economic. So, for example, Bernie Sanders, who's the, right now at least, the leader of the more liberal wing of the party, has said if you are not for universal health care run by the government, which is to say Medicare for all, you are not a Democrat. So that is the new litmus test.
So wait a minute. The person who's not a Democrat is telling us what it means to be
a
Democrat.
So there's another irony. Yeah, the guy who's not actually a member of our party is sort of in charge at least of a wing of our party. You know, he did run for the party nomination. But right, that's another weird thing. He just doesn't happen to be a Democrat. But the debate going on inside the party really now is over what is the fundamental economic vision for Democrats. What Sanders is saying is the problem we're trying to solve is income inequality, which is everybody acknowledges is an enormous problem. The way we're going to solve it is by making existing government programs, Social Security, Medicare, education support programs, making those massively bigger. Others in the party, like my organization, are saying actually the real problem isn't income inequality. The real that's a symptom. The disease is that opportunity is too concentrated in certain places. If you live in Palo Alto, your opportunity looks very different than if you live in Scranton.
Or Syracuse.
Or Syracuse, yeah. To be sure. And it's this concentration of opportunity in too few places and for too few people. If you live in the wrong place or you're in the wrong demographic group or you have the wrong kind of education, it's very difficult to earn a good life. And so the solutions to the concentration of opportunity look different than the solutions to the concentration of wealth. And that, I think, is the most fundamental kind of disagreement inside the party right now.
And I wanted to press you a little bit on how important it is for the Democratic Party to find unity on that piece of its affirmative message, the one that it's arguing over. Because it seems to me, at least historically, one of the strengths of the Democratic Party in the 20th century was the fact that it was a really big tent and it could accommodate differences of views. And you were talking about some of the things that Democrats now have sort of all come together on. So why is this unity so important? Why couldn't you have a party that would have differences of view that would articulate those in different areas of the country where they resonated more?
I think that's a great point. And our view is that we should have a huge tent and we should have people talking about things that work in the areas where they're running. But that isn't a view universally shared. If you look at what happened in the Virginia governor's race, Sanders came in and endorsed Ralph Northam, the governor-elect's primary opponent, who lost. Tom Perriello lost by 11 points in the primary back in June. And Sanders then sat out the general election. He refused to endorse Ralph Northam. And his affiliated organizations, Our Revolution and Democracy for America, actively worked against Northam because they said he wasn't pure enough on some things. So that is what I think Democrats have to guard against. We are in too attenuated a position politically. We are in too deep a hole to be imposing litmus tests and then trying to enforce them in ways that the Tea Party did for Republicans. We need to be following a fairly broad path here, or there's just no way to get back.
And in recent weeks, there have been these revelations about on the Democratic side, the National Party organization's workings during and before the primaries. And I think I guess I'm wondering whether, A, this is complicating that effort to find unity, and B, how important that is going to be going forward, or is that something the party's just going to get over?
I happen to think that's kind of an insider's game. I think there are people that are going to be irritated about what went on, but I don't think for the most part it's going to have any impact on voters. It's not helpful, and I was extraordinarily displeased to see this burst out into the open once again just a couple of days before a very important election in Virginia. It doesn't help. And it can dampen the enthusiasm of our core supporters who need to get out there and get the vote out. But I think mostly that's just noise and probably won't matter.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher. I'm talking with Matt Bennett. He's the co-founder and senior vice president for public affairs at the Washington, D.C.-based think tank Third Way. Matt, I want to come back and get you to explore in a little more depth what you were talking about briefly earlier, the affirmative message that you and your organization would see as the best one for the Democratic Party. You were talking about opportunity rather than income inequality, the latter being the symptom, the former being the disease. So tell me more about what you think the Democratic Party's message and its policies need to be in that area of opportunity.
You know, if you look at the overall performance of the American economy, it looks pretty strong. We have very low unemployment nationally. We've had median wages have gone up nationally. The problem is if you break that out by county, the situation is unbelievably stark. We've had incredibly robust growth in some places, and we've had people slipping backwards in most other places. When you map, for example, the median income between 2005 and 2015 by county, it looks almost exactly like the county map in the 2016 presidential election. Mm. That is to say, where median incomes have fallen in real terms, Trump won. Where they went up, Clinton won. And as you know from looking at that map, most of the country falls into the red in either scenario. So we need to do a much better job of ensuring the people that live in places that don't have venture capital flowing in, that don't have new business starts going up, that have median income slipping back. We need to find a way to get people opportunity in those places. Americans are very particular about what they want and what they need. What they want in the economy is opportunity. And what they respect is the opportunity to earn a good life. This isn't France. People aren't looking for the government to come in and hand them a check for doing nothing. People want to work.
A month of vacation in the summer sounds nice, though.
Absolutely. They want a middle-class right. life. And when you talk to people who are living hand-to-mouth, it is almost unimaginable to them someone would pay them to go on vacation for 2 weeks. Mm. But they want that, and they deserve that. Everyone everywhere should have that opportunity to be able to send their kids to college and own a home and retire in dignity and cover their health care costs and take a vacation. That's middle class life. And too many people don't have that. So our view is that this is a very disruptive moment in the economy. We are seeing globalization and technology change things almost as radically as the Industrial Revolution changed things 150 years ago. And like then, government needs to do a bunch of things to help people manage this transition. And right now, it's doing virtually nothing.
So tell me more about those things. What things do you have in mind that government should be doing then?
Well, let me give you a couple examples. One is apprenticeship programs, which have worked unbelievably well in Germany. Everyone always points to that as the example. 3.8 million students graduated from American high schools last year. There were 40,000 apprenticeships. I mean, that just is ridiculous. We need many, many more than that. So there are a lot of incentives the government could put into place that would help companies create and run successful apprenticeship programs. Generally speaking, we have a big problem with kids moving into fields that don't require a four-year degree. Only about 30% of the American public is going to end up with a four-year degree. 70% won't. We need a much better system to match skills to work to ensure that community colleges are preparing students for the jobs in that area, because a lot of these folks don't want or cannot leave the places where they live. They need to be able to work close to home. Give you one more example. Right now, one of the big problems that leads to the symptom of income inequality is that capital returns better investment than labor.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't have access to the capital markets because they don't have any savings. What if we insisted that everyone in every job, starting when you get your first job at McDonald's at age 17, gets 50 cents an hour in a pension that travels with you throughout your life? It's in addition to Social Security. We wouldn't touch Social Security. If you only earned 50 cents an hour for your entire life and that went into a pension, you would retire with double what you would retire with Social Security alone. Mm. That would fundamentally change people's retirement experience. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things government can do, but it's going to take kind of a reform of government to get there.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Matt Bennett from the Washington, D.C. think tank Third Way. Matt, you mentioned earlier the most recent elections earlier this November and some of the wins that Democrats had there, and they have been celebrating those results. A little bit more in depth on that. Do you see anything new and of real significance in those races, or is there any that you would lift out and say, here is something that really means something?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things, both good and bad news for Democrats. The good news is that Trump hatred is deep and abiding. It is intense, particularly in the suburbs. And Virginia is now a state that is basically driven by the suburbs, mostly of Washington, but then mm-hmm. some around Richmond and, mm-hmm. and other cities in Virginia. However, where Ralph Northam won big in those places, massively outperforming Hillary Clinton's totals from a year earlier, he lost by bigger margins than Clinton and bigger margins than Terry McAuliffe, the son of Syracuse, who's our incumbent governor, did in 2013 in virtually everywhere else. So
further polarization.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The for the most part, white working class part of Virginia, which is most of it by geography but not by population, turned out for his opponent Ed Gillespie in massive numbers. Mm. So this is a real warning sign for Democrats, which is, yes, we're going to do really, really well in the higher income, better educated suburban areas, but we're still in a deep hole with the rural areas.
So it sounds like you would then take issue with one of the takes that I've heard from the recent set of elections, that this is the beginning of the tsunami. This, we can see it. This is the beginning of the wave that's going to give Democrats control in Congress. You're not. It doesn't sound like you're seeing that in and of itself.
Not yet. It is possible, and I certainly am fervently hoping that it is. And it's possible that we could cobble together enough suburban districts, if performance in 18 is just like 17, to win back the House by a narrow margin. But if we don't do better in some of these white working class areas, there is no way that we can return to power in big numbers at the state legislative level or even in the Senate. And so that has to turn around.
So let's talk a little bit about the other side of the aisle. Let's talk about the Republicans. How serious are the fissures within the Republican Party, and what's driving them? I mean, you talked about Trump before, but is there anything more than Trump that's causing their effort, their need to self-examine?
This is as vicious a war inside a party, I think, that we've had in certainly since we've had the modern Republican and Democratic Party. We've never seen anything like this. Maybe when the students were on the streets in 1968 outside the convention. But I think these fissures go deeper and are wider inside the Republican electorate than even those might have been.
Hmm.
And I think Trump is driving much of this, but he is a symbol for a kind of identity politics and nationalism that one wing of the party feels very, very deeply, as opposed to a more conservative, in both senses of the word, approach that the establishment wing of the party is much more comfortable with. And what you're seeing play out in Alabama, for instance, is the conservatives trying to become comfortable with a kind of type of Republicanism they don't like, hoping that, well, the guy will vote for tax cuts, so we're going to be with him. Mm-hmm. But at some point that he became so distasteful to them, they had to flee. Now, it's not all going to be about pedophilia and overt, you know, completely, you know, unfit people like Roy Moore. But you're seeing Steve Bannon's wing of the party put forward people that Mitch McConnell really can't live with. So this fight could get worse.
What direction do you think it's ultimately going to be resolved in? I mean, where would you see this going?
Well, I think even for a war like this, the outcome isn't going to be set until they lose the White House.
Okay.
When I mean, the pendulum always swings, whether it's in 2020 or beyond, the Democrats regain control. Ultimately, there will be a struggle for the soul of the Republican Party. And either it will be a smoldering hole in the ground, having lost them massively, or it will be just a fractious set of actors who are still on the stage. We don't know. But it is anybody's guess as to who is going to win this fight. I think everyone in Washington is just gobsmacked by how quickly the party has changed. The Tea Party didn't achieve this kind of change, but the Bannonites have, because they have the White House.
Just got a minute left, but there's an irony to what you're saying when I put some of the dots together and draw the lines, and that's that if the Democrats are able to unite around the message that you're putting forward around the economy and opportunity, and that becomes the central theme, and the Republicans then go in this more identity direction that you've identified, there's kind of an interesting switch. The Republicans become the party of identity, and the Democrats become the party of the economy. That would be an interesting thing to see how that would play out.
Yeah, we could be at one of these pivot points in American politics. Obviously, we've seen it before. Democrats used to be the racists, you know, not that long ago, within the lifetime of my parents. And so we might have a kind of switch coming. I'm not certain, by the way, that my part of the party is going to prevail in this struggle for an economic vision. And I think having an enemy as incredibly dangerous as Donald Trump will keep Democrats united for now. But it's not clear that identity politics is going to exit the Democratic family anytime soon either.
And just a few seconds left. On the Democratic side, and it's early, but, you know, we're already starting this, the presidential sweepstakes. On the Democratic side, anybody that you're seeing that you think is really looking intriguing, interesting as a possible nominee in 2020?
You know, this is the thing I get asked all the time. Not yet. But remember that at this point in the cycle in 1992, Bill Clinton was still the guy that gave a really bad speech at the 88 convention.
I remember that speech.
Yeah, it was bad. So I think it's too early to tell.
That was Matt Bennett. Matt, it was good to talk to you again.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.